It's early in the morning, isn't it? I would like to, I'm Diane Vines. I'm a professor of nursing at the University of Portland in Portland, Oregon. It's a faith-based university, and we have a very, very large nursing program. I'm also the author of this book, which I'll talk a little bit about. It's called Angel Walk, Nurses at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you know about military life at all, there's two reasons for the title Angel Walk. One is that nurses are in war are usually known as angels and have been known as angels to the soldiers for a long time. But in addition, when a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan is killed, their bodies are transported on a casket stretcher kind of thing, and their comrades all line up along each side, and they're taken to the plane to take them out and take them back to the United States, and that is called an angel walk. And nurses are the ones who arrange for angel walks. In fact, one nurse will be assigned that as her primary responsibility is to arrange angel walks for fallen soldiers. It's a very trying and traumatic experience for the nurse as well as for, obviously, the soldiers. If we look at the nurses and women at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, between 2001 and 2008 alone, about 190,000 women. About 190,000 military women served in Iraq and Afghanistan. As you know, thank you. Will it just right-click, you think? Or I'll do it. Women make up about 11.3% of the OIF veterans now. You know, the OEF, Operation Enduring Freedom, and OIF, so that's Iraq and Afghanistan. About 20% of these service women end up with PTSD symptoms. Now, and that's probably very underestimated because we're finding that people are coming back and having symptomatology years later, and nurses especially deny that they're having any PTSD and come back to the States because they feel guilty about the fact that they haven't been the ones who have actually fought in the war, and so they will often deny those symptoms, and years later they'll get into treatment for some of those symptoms, and all of a sudden when they're asked about their experience in the war, they will connect that PTSD experience. Women have about 2 to 3 times the rate of PTSD as men, and that is because women are more susceptible to suffering trauma, stress reactions, then that makes it even more difficult for these 11% women. In addition, something that I don't have up here that is really very disturbing is that about 20% of military women describe having had a sexual harassment or sexual abuse experience, including rape, by their comrades, and that is, and sometimes by their superiors. And for many years, this was overlooked, and they would report it, and it would not, nothing would be done. Maybe they'd be transferred to another unit, or the person who had raped them or abused them would be transferred, but oftentimes nothing was done about it, and the new leadership in the Army and the Veterans Affairs has said that this will not happen anymore, and from now on those women will be treated, and those service people who have abused them will be punished. About 250,000 women vets sought care in veteran facilities. And this is unusual because the veterans facilities are not always capable of handling women vets. So there's now an effort to open women veteran centers around the country. Portland has one that's just about to open, so that they can be treated differently than the men are treated. And they're about female veterans are about two to four times more likely to be homeless. Even World War II vets who were usually, I mean, they were always support people, and nurses, they were not even allowed to be treated they were not considered combat veterans for many years. And so it wasn't until really after Vietnam that was opened up for women to be served, to be treated. And then now we're serving even World War II veterans. Women veterans, but that was a very, very difficult situation. So this is the book. I have more information about that if you would like to see it. Oh, wrong way here. Let's see. There we go. Now, it's very unusual, of course, in the earlier wars for women to be in direct combat positions. To our knowledge, the only nurses, for example, who bore arms against the enemy were nurses when Corregidor was overrun. Those nurses, both the Filipino and American nurses, took up arms and shot people and shot the Japanese. That is very unusual. However, in Iraq and Afghanistan, even the support people, including nurses and other support like physicians, aren't allowed to go out of their unit, out of their barracks, basically, without a black jacket and a helmet and a sidearm. And nurses are expected to protect their soldiers with the sidearm if that is necessary. So that's very unusual, and that makes for a quite different experience in war. Since they're in direct combat positions now, and because in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, there's no such thing as a front line. If you look at Vietnam or other wars, if you look at MASH, they're actually in the sort of behind the front lines, right? And every once in a while they get kind of in the front lines, but not often. And that was really the Korean War. But now there's no such thing as a front line in these wars. So the support people are actually exposed to as much trauma and as much incoming grenades and IEDs and all of those sorts of things as the combat veterans. And then having been in a previous combat situation increases the chances of getting PTSD for both warriors and for support staff. So if you've been in a previous combat situation, you're more likely to get PTSD. If you have been deployed before, you're more likely to get PTSD. If you are deployed longer, you're more likely to get PTSD. So if you think about the fact that we keep increasing increasing the length of deployments so that nurses as well as everyone else, for example, would serve for 15, they were going for 12 months and then all of a sudden they'd be told they were going to be there for 15 months. Their family's at home, their kids are at home, they have a hard time explaining that to little children. And so this has dramatically increased the amount of stress in wartime. National Guard troops and reservists have not often served this Gesundheit this many times, and in this case, National Guard and reservists go, and then they come back and they reintegrate into the civilian, or hopefully reintegrate into the civilian world. So they often aren't in a place that they're treated by the VA. So they go back into the regular primary care system. They're treated in regular hospitals, and people don't know anything about PTSD, and they don't know and depression. And of course, then the suicides have increased dramatically. We're missing them. People in primary care are not serving these veterans well. When they re-enter, they don't have the support of all those people who have shared that experience with them. We find that young warriors are especially at risk for wartime stress disorders. And as you know, many of the Army men and women are basically recent high school graduates, and they are ill-prepared for the kind of stress that these current wars provide them. The treatment systems are not accustomed to treating young and female veterans, and so they're likely not to get the kind of especially intensive care that they need for these stress reactions and depression. They're likely to seek help in large numbers in the next couple of years, because what we know is that these wartime effects are often not felt for a certain time after the war. So let me just read you a reentry story. Our book has 27 stories of nurses, both men and women, who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam, and the comparisons. Captain Maria got a preview of how she might react when she got home when she escorted a patient being air-vac'd to Germany. She cried as she described an incident of how once she dropped the patient off at a hospital in Germany. She was sitting at a bus stop and suddenly I broke down. I never cried so hard in my life. After I left the patient, I fell apart. I was sitting there at the bus stop watching the whole world go by, and then it hit me. Everything here was normal. There were no mortars coming out of the sky. People were chit-chatting and cars were going by with families. That's when I said to myself, nobody knows what's going on over there. Nobody knows all the pain that we have, all the sadness, all the loneliness, all the misery. I could have cried. I've never cried so much in my life. There's also a film called Lioness, the film, and it's wonderful about this. I'd like to talk a second about assessing PTSD in primary care settings. As I mentioned, it's extremely important that as we emphasize medical homes and primary care settings in the Healthcare Affordability Act, that people screen for these PTSD reactions and depression, both in civilians and wartime. You know, we know we have many more trauma victims from rape and child abuse and sexual abuse than we ever had, than we realized. And now we've got all of the wartime PTSD, and we're not very good about screening those in primary care settings. These tools have to be socially acceptable, they have to be valid, and they have to be very easy to use. Three that we recommend for primary care providers: there's the National Center for PTSD quick checklist for trauma symptoms. It's called the Primary Care PTSD Screen. And this one has four questions that are asked. And those questions are all about the four categories of symptoms. The categories of symptoms are reliving the event or re-experiencing the event, avoidance of anything that is similar to the event, numbing, and inability to feel anything, emotions, feeling keyed up and hypervigilant. That's what you hear about people dropping to the ground when they hear a firecracker go off, for example. That's the hypervigilance. There's also that PTSD checklist, the PCL, which is used for both civilian and military victims, and it has 17 items that are symptoms, basically, and you ask about whether they've had these any of these symptoms in the past month. And this one is basically, it's not at all too extremely, and we like that Likert-type scale because it really does get at the severity of the symptoms much better. Then the DSM-4 test is also another one that's used, and that one is a yes-no answer on 24 items of symptoms. And that's, are you just currently experiencing? So some are 2 weeks, in the last 2 weeks, some are in the last month, some are currently, some are in the last year. And that makes a tremendous difference as to how the results come out. So you want to know for sure that you are doing them. Let me just talk a second then about the kinds of treatment strategies that are best. We're using cognitive behavioral therapy where we're trying to change the way the person thinks about the experience so that the emotions about that experience change. One of those cognitive therapies is cognitive processing therapy, and you try to help them understand that the things that happened to them were totally outside of their control. Then group therapy, medications, of course. And I'm currently certified nationally as a rapid resolution therapy therapist, and there are about 200 of us nationally. This is a brand new therapy written up recently in Soldiers Magazine, which goes to all of the enlisted and retired people in the Army. And it's a very rapid way of disconnecting those emotions from that original experience. It's wonderful if you ever have a chance to see it. So I'll end now. Thank you.